This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart and we're heading straight to Solomon Islands where Prime Minister Manase Sogavare is blaming foreign powers for encouraging the civil unrest that has engulfed the capital city. Honiara has been racked with violence over the last 48 hours or so, with protests and rioting leaving a trail of destruction in the centre of the city and the Chinatown district. Mr Sogavare has thanked Australia for sending police and defence personnel to help restore peace. Shortly, we'll be hearing from the Solomon's opposition leader Matthew Wale and former Australian High Commissioner James Batley. But first, this report from Melissa Clark.
The protests in Honiara swelled swiftly. Frustrations burst into violence at a pace that caught most by surprise. Speaking to the ABC from Honiara, Prime Minister Manase Sogavare described the state of the capital.
There's people on the street, and the police are trying to manage that because they are overstretched. The buildings are torched and they're on the streets. So that's the situation as we speak now.
The Australian government responded quickly to the call for help. The 23 federal police officers that are already in Honiara will be joined by 43 army officers today, with another 50 personnel from the AFP and a patrol boat on the way too. Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
It's our hope and ambition that our presence will seek to calm the situation in the Solomon Islands and to restore some peacefulness, which will enable the normal peaceful ways of seeking to resolve any issues there.
He's treading carefully in offering security assistance, but not intervention.
Our presence there does not indicate any position on the internal issues of the Solomon Islands.
The protests against the central government, primarily by people from the Malaita province, turned violent, fuelled by a mixture of grievances, alleged corruption, poor public services, but most significantly, the Sogavare government's decision in 2019 to abandon diplomatic ties with Taiwan to recognise China. It was highly controversial, opposed by the Premier of the Malaita province, who has maintained ties with Taipei, and the opposition leader, who is demanding Mr Sogavare resign.
That guy is right behind all that is happening. He encouraged the people of Malaita to come over to Honiara to disturb our parliament. So he's actually wasting his time calling for my resignation. What he's advancing, of course, is totally undemocratic. I'm not going to bow down to anyone. We are intact, the government is intact, and we're going to defend democracy.
Do you still stand by that decision to switch diplomatic allegiance? And how much?
Oh, yeah. That's the only issue. The only issue, unfortunately, is influenced and encouraged by other powers. These very countries that are now influencing Malaita, the countries that have diplomatic tie with the People's Republic of China. And they are discouraging Solomon Islands to enter into diplomatic relations and to comply with international law and the United Nations resolution.
How much do you see external pressures being responsible here? Is this
very big influence. I don't want to name names, but we'll leave it there. We know who they are.
Manase Sogavare insists external powers are behind the outbreak of violence, dismissing other grievances about his government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Australia did not see evidence of foreign interference.
They are domestic expressions about those issues. They are not the result of the actions of, to the best of our knowledge, of any other agency outside of the Solomon Islands.
That's Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, ending that report by Melissa Clark. You heard mention there of the opposition leader in Solomon Islands, Matthew Wale. We hope to be talking to him very shortly. In fact, I think we have Matthew Wale on the line right now. First, though, I should point out 2 days after the protests began in Honiara, with those crowds calling for Prime Minister Sogavare to stand down, the situation on the ground still extremely tense, people still out and about, despite the government ordering a 36-hour lockdown. And ABC freelance journalist Chris and Rita Amano Leong has been speaking to some of them.
I feel it's not good how the people They do many things like burning house and other properties and people. And how I feel, that's not good.
Are you scared?
Yes, I'm scared for that because it's not good. I think that might be affect for the people.
I'm feeling not safe and secure, and some of the things like last-minute lockdown that happened in the country, we're not ready for it. Some of our people are now facing hungry, and some, that's why they forcing to in the town to break some stores and taking some food.
And in your opinion, what do you want the government to do?
I want the government to respond to the people. Like, if he to step down, he should be stepped down so that the country peaceful back as normal.
Views on the ground in Honiara. We're joined now by the Solomon Islands opposition leader, Matthew Awale. He's joined the call for the Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, to stand down. And Mr. Awale joins us from Honiara. Very good morning to you. Welcome to Pacific Beat. Good morning, Matthew Awale. Okay, looks like we might be having one or two problems at getting the line through to Solomon's just at the moment. Should just point out that Australia is sending more than 60 Federal Police and Defence Force personnel to the islands. Prime Minister Scott Morrison in Canberra confirming that he received a formal request for help from his Solomon Islands counterpart before convening a meeting of Australia's National Security Committee. And I believe we can talk to Matthew Awale now on the line from Honiara. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Richard.
Tell me, what is your assessment of the situation in Solomon's capital right now? The last 2 days clearly scenes that nobody wants to see. What have you made of it all?
Well, it's a terrible tragedy. And unfortunately, we've been under lockdown. So I've been locked down in my house and I've not been able to assess the situation for myself. So I can't speak to the accuracy of how terrible it is. I just hear that it is really, really terrible. Further, I listened to that first segment of the Prime Minister speaking, Sogavare, and I must say I categorically reject his accusation that I am behind any of this. I have never condoned any violence, unlike him, who was part of the coup in 2000, and I am not a man of violence. I never encouraged militants to enter into violent confrontation. The coward escaped from Parliament when we were still meeting and left the rest of us with no protection to face the violence. My car was...
Looks like we've lost the line through to Honiara once again. Apologies for that. Obviously having one or two technical difficulties at this point. What we may try and do is see if we can link up with the former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands. That's James Batley. But perhaps we'll just take a brief moment to try and make that connection. Back now to the main story of the morning and the situation in Solomon Islands. And Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison has confirmed receiving a formal request for help from his Solomon Islands counterpart, Manasseh Sogavare. This is before convening a meeting of Australia's National Security Committee. 23 federal police officers left Australia last night. Dozens more were told on standby, and more than 40 defence personnel will be deployed later today. Mr. Morrison says a request for help has also been sent to the government of Papua New Guinea.
Our purpose here is to provide stability and security to enable the normal constitutional processes within the Solomon Islands to be able to deal with the various issues that have arisen, and that that be done in a climate of peace and stability and security. It is not the Australian government's intention in any way to intervene in the internal affairs of the Solomon Islands. That is for them to resolve. I've made that very clear. Our presence there does not indicate any position on the internal issues of the Solomon Islands. It is there in direct response to a request made by the Prime Minister so we can be present to assist the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force to be able to ensure that police can provide stability and security so the normal constitutional processes can be undertaken.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison. He anticipates the deployment to the Solomons will last several weeks. Well, joining us now is former Australian High Commissioner to the Solomons, James Batley. He led the regional security mission at Ramsey for 2 years, the last time Honiara called on Canberra for assistance to restore order in the country. And that, of course, took rather a long time. Mr. Batley, good morning. Thank you for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Good morning.
So what do you make of the situation at the moment? I guess it's a small amount of Australian assistance that's going in at this stage, but could this prove to be the thin end of the wedge? Are we looking at potential for another Ramsey?
I don't think so at this point. I think the Australian government sees this as hopefully this contribution as acting as a bit of a circuit breaker, and helping to support the local police authorities just to bring the disturbances under control. I don't think we're facing a really large scale build up like we saw in Ramsey.
What is your view of how this has come about? I mean, the finger is being firmly pointed by Prime Minister Sogavare at the Premier in Malaita, Mr. Suidani, because of the rift between the two of them over which country Solomon Islands should have diplomatic ties to. Should it be Taiwan or should it be China? But, I mean, ultimately, I mean, is that really a single reason for what we've seen in Honiara over the last few days, or do you think there's more to it than that?
No, I think that's a symptom of the problem rather than the cause of it. I think that there's a range of pretty deep-seated grievances that have come to the surface here, and these are problems, really deep-seated problems of development, of perceptions of unequal benefits of development, but also concerns about corruption. And I guess that's how that's why this China factor plays into it. And certainly when there have been previous disturbances in the past, that the major disturbances in 2006 were also when Chinatown was targeted, there was a lot of accusations of corruption and collusive behaviour between political leaders and Chinese businesses. So that's all sort of fed into the mix this time around as well.
Scott Morrison has been at pains as Australia's Prime Minister to say, yes, we will offer some assistance, which Australia have done, but absolutely distancing himself really from the underlying causes. So I guess the geopolitics here is pretty sensitive, isn't it? Because Scott Morrison doesn't want to be seen to be on one side of the China-Taiwan debate.
Well, he's distancing himself from the politics, and I think he's absolutely right to do that. I think the groups of police and military that are going in, and some foreign affairs officials have got a bit of a tightrope to walk, that they don't get caught up in the politics of the situation. I think it's good that the Prime Minister said that, so they're clearly conscious of that risk. And I think what will work in favour of the Australian forces that are going in is I think, a very strong sense amongst the general public of relief that there is some sort of external assistance coming. So I think it will be a big confidence booster. But they'll have to be careful about the politics of the situation.
And I wonder also if there could be a sting in the tail here with Australian personnel heading to Solomon Islands, a country which up to now in the community has been COVID-19 free. Now, I'm presuming that all these personnel will be double vaccinated, but nevertheless, I mean, this is the kind of risk that Solomon Islands would really rather not take.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I'm not sure what specific measures have been taken by the Australian contingent to minimise that risk. But that's right. Solomons is still at an early stage of its vaccine rollout, so that is a very real risk.
And as far as Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare is concerned, he sounds pretty determined that he's going to stay in that position. But how vulnerable do you think he is in light of what's happened in the last couple of days?
Oh, very difficult for me to speculate on that one, but he has he's a formidable politician. He's been Prime Minister four times of his country, but he's also lost power in a number of motions of no confidence over the years. So clearly the opposition will be working frantically to pick apart the governing coalition. It's just impossible to say at this stage what might happen.
James Battley, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning. We'll leave it there. That's James Battley, former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands. And I believe we can talk once again now to the opposition leader in the Solomon Islands Parliament, Matthew Wiley. Mr. Wiley, thank you again for joining us. Technical problems not helping us this morning. Hopefully you can hear me well now.
I can hear you fine. Thank you, Richard.
Excellent. Now, the very clear point that you made a little earlier in the program was that you have had nothing to do with instigating what's happened over the last 48 hours or so in Honiara. So perhaps we can broaden the issue. I mean, why has this happened? What do you believe has gone wrong here for the country?
Firstly, I think there is a situation of state capture. James Battley alluded to some of that. The people in this country feel that the democratic processes are not working for them, that their own government is the puppet of China, and Chinese money is being used to persecute Malaita, particularly. Of course, logging and mining sectors have long controlled Solovare and have supported his tenure in prime ministership. They have always funded his elections as prime minister. So people obviously feel powerless to change it through the democratic process. This is a prime minister who, before the election, was part of Kandere Party. Then after the election, registered his own so-called Our Party and then used money to get all the other MPs to be part of it and to back him. He's a very cunning guy.
But in many ways, isn't that typical of the horse trading that tends to go on, not just in Solomon Islands, but in other Pacific Island countries pre and post-election?
Well, I suppose the people have had enough of it.
So they are seeking a radical change, therefore, an end to the lack of political system, if you like, that exists in Solomon Islands.
Correct. And I think in terms of Malaita, they are emboldened by Premier Suidani and what the public in Malaita was able to do to secure Suidani and his government. Now, Prime Minister Solovare, using Chinese money, tried to bribe 19 provincial members to desert and remove Suidani and his government. That's the cause partly of this problem. He has not stopped persecuting Malaita.
Now, clearly, I mean, he's pointed the finger at Premier Suidani and suggested that he has stirred up the trouble in Honiara. But I guess that the other aspect in this is the suggestion that there are external factors at play. I mean, if there are external influences, where do you think they're coming from? Is it China? Is it Taiwan? I mean, who's behind this?
Well, I don't think that anyone is behind it. This is all domestic. I think it's folly to blame anyone from outside. But what I do know that currently there is promise of $250,000 each Solomon dollars to each member of parliament not to desert Solovare, and that is coming from China. And a week and a half ago, China paid $1 million to two MPs. And that purpose of that $2 million is to divide former militants to use them against the protesters. So these guys knew there was a protest that was coming on, obviously, and they were preparing to divide and conquer. Unfortunately, that didn't work, but it's Chinese money. So if there is foreign interference, it is that, I reckon.
How then do you view Australia's involvement in the request for assistance to Papua New Guinea as well? I mean, are you concerned that this could be the start of a long-term Australian involvement, or do you feel that the small contingent that's coming into the country can sort things out fairly quickly?
Oh, well, I welcome the Australian support, and he should have requested that way before, because it now appears he had prior knowledge of how bad the situation could get. He waited too long to request that support. And Prime Minister Morrison's announcement that it is a matter of weeks to stabilize the situation, I think, is good. I'm hoping that last night, since they have landed, that those who have been perpetrating violence and looting will have realized and gone away and stopped the violence. But I don't know. I'm still cooped up in my house because of the lockdown.
Yes, so you're sticking to the rules, but clearly quite a lot of other people are not currently. And going back to Prime Minister Sogavare's position and as you describe it, I mean, the push in the country apparently for greater democracy, if I can put it that way, I'm wondering if one of the things that may have helped to stoke this up is the suggestion that the election might be put back for a year with the Pacific Games coming up and the government suggesting they should put it on hold, which will, I imagine, not go down well with those who would like to see Mr. Sogavare go.
This is absolutely right. Sogavare never went to the people in the last elections for a mandate to extend the life of parliament. Now, the Tokyo Olympics postponed by a year, and the public are saying, why is the Pacific Games so difficult to postpone by a year? Why do we have to amend our constitution for that? It's just another of Sogavare's power grab. He's all about power, he's reaping benefits when he's in power. This is the problem, and people have had enough of it.
So as things stand at the moment, will he survive, in your view, as Prime Minister?
Well, ironically, the Australian support, which we need and are thankful for, will protect him. And, of course, with Chinese money to keep members. A lot of members have called me and expressed their desire to resign and have openly said that they want to take the $250,000 also before they resign. Now, his practice always with this Chinese money is to, when there is some instability in his coalition, is to promise them so that they all settle down and then he gives them after Parliament sits so they can't turn on him.
And a final point, I mean, what message would you send out to those who've perpetrated the violence and the looting in Honiara over the last couple of days? Because regardless of what it is they're seeking, this is not the right way to go about it, surely.
It certainly is not the right way to go about it. They should spare a thought for many of the innocent victims of this tragic violence. Even the Chinese businesses, they're innocent. And many indigenous Solomon Islander businesses were also torched and suffered loss. This is a real tragedy of immense scale.
Matthew Wiley, thank you very much indeed for talking to us on Pacific Beat this morning. We will leave it there. That's Matthew Wiley, the opposition leader in Solomon Islands, with his thoughts on the troubles that have erupted over the last 48 hours in the capital city, Honiara. Australian assistance on its way, small numbers at the moment, and hopefully that's the way it will stay. Now, time to take a check on the weather picture over the Pacific for the next day or so. We're joined by Neville Coop, Director of the Nandraki Weather Service. Good morning to you, Neville.
Hi, good morning, Richard.
So how are things looking in the region for today and into the weekend?
Yes, well, so the big weather news this week has been the declaration by the Bureau to match their compatriots across the Tasman in New Zealand that we are now into an active El Niño or La Niña event. And certainly the weather pattern we're seeing set up across the Pacific and also about the eastern part of Australia is very much in keeping with that that sort of weather pattern, which has really been in place now for a couple of months. So the declaration of an active La Niña is really not much of a surprise, but it just means that certain thresholds have been met. And so it's all bona fide now. But for the most part, weather is confined at the moment to around Vanuatu and Fiji and pushing up into southern parts of Tuvalu and the Wallace and Island group. A little cluster of cloud and thunderstorms there associated with an upper level weather feature. Actually, it's a mid and upper level low pressure, which is over the southern parts of Vanuatu near Tanna and Ambrim and those sort of places. So it's going to be a bit damp around Fiji today and over the weekend, and that'll spread probably east into Tonga from the far south, Tongatapu, right up to the Northern Islands over the course of the weekend. And it may also spread as far east as Samoa, perhaps later in the weekend, and certainly still a bit of rain around Rotuma, Wallace and Futuna, and parts of northern Vanuatu this morning. But interestingly, the atolls to the north along the equator remain very dry. They're starting to see some real stress there with the lack of rain and the freshwater lenses starting to dry up now, even as we not even yet into summer. But again, that's another feature of La Nina, and so that's likely to continue at least through the first couple of months of the new year. So really everything set up for transition. Still no sign of any active cyclone activity. We have had one off the west coast of Australia earlier in the week, but no signs of any activity in our part of the world just yet. But we do expect that the rainfall will pick up more generally across the Melanesia and into the western parts of Polynesia around Fiji and Tonga during the early part of December as we start to see a Mandurian wave move across to the Pacific. So all in all, very much in keeping with the La Nina conditions we've seen prevailing, and I can't see things changing very much, and certainly not before the end of the month, and probably stay that way into the early parts of December.
Yeah, well, thank you very much indeed for that comprehensive update. So there's a weather picture there from Neville Coop, Director of the Nan Draki Weather Service, for us here on Pacific Beat. Now to other matters, and tech and startup talent could soon be flocking to Samoa if the government's plan to establish a Silicon Valley-style technology and innovation hub on its shores proves to be successful. The government is reported to have made the announcement regarding such a plan at some stage during this month. Dubravka Volodea has been taking a look at the proposals. So, Dubravka, exactly what is the government planning to do?
So, according to reports by the Samoa Observer, the government is planning to become the Silicon Valley of the Pacific. Silicon Valley is an area in California in the United States, and it's a global hub for technology and innovation. Many of the global high-tech companies are based there, and it's also a hub for startups. Technologies such as the microprocessor and the microcomputer were developed there. Talks in Samoa started in the capital Apia this month. It's understood that the government is planning a tech and innovation facility to establish a hub in the Pacific. I spoke to Priscilla Kevin, who's the co-founder of Infornet and a PNG IT specialist. This is her reaction to the plan.
It's really good that we have these kinds of discussions happening in our region. It's good to see some more thinking about promoting their local tech talent and getting the support of the Samoan government to establish the innovation tech park, which will bring out some of this great talent for Samoa.
Now, that was Priscilla Kevin, co-founder of Infornet. And are there any more details, Dubravka, about exactly what Samoa has in mind here?
Well, details are a bit sketchy. We contacted the ministry to find out more details, but were unsuccessful. The Samoa Observer says that the ministry is doing all it can so that Samoa can become digitally transformed. Now, according to the reports, the CEO at the ministry, Fualao Matao Matafeo, said that talks of the initiative first started in 2019. Now, that was when the Tui Samoa cable first arrived. That's the submarine cable that connects Samoa with Fiji and Wallis and Futuna. That cable provides Samoa with access to broadband internet. According to the site Data Reportal, there are about 67,000 internet users in Samoa as of January this year. So that's about 33% of the population compared to 41.3% in Tonga as of this year, for example. Now, the government also wants to foster a closer relationship between the private sector, academia, and the government with this initiative. I asked Ms. Kevin what her advice would be to Samoa.
I think for Samoa, it's really looking, taking stock of their current ecosystem, which players are in the ecosystem from the private sector, the government, and the academia. When we started the project in 2014, which was born from an economic cluster concept, we had to look at the triple helix innovation model, which is where we had those three key pillars, government, private sector, and academia. For Samoa to be able to create an innovation tech facility for their country, they would need to take stock of the current ecosystem players and how to bring them into that whole conversation of creating innovation culture.
Now, is the government planning Dubrovka to serve only Samoans, or could this scheme go wider across the region?
So the planned Samoan Tech and Innovation Hub is to serve the local tech industry. But the government wants it to also become a regional hub for the Pacific. We understand that the plan is to also attract research and development talent from the region to Samoa. However, Ms. Kevin from PNG told me that in her opinion, Samoa should start small and stay local to start with.
I think for every journey, you always have to start home. So it's really developing that brand, developing that trust, and then engaging with the rest of the Pacific region on how you can collaborate on many different projects or initiatives that drive your agenda for your innovation tech facility.
Now, finally, Dubrovka, are any other examples of this sort of thing happening around the Pacific?
Yes, so Ms. Kevin told me that her vision for her country, PNG, is very similar.
We have the same similar vision, and I think the vision is really about promoting our local talent, our human capital, a great human capital we have in the region, and also to collaborate with the rest of the world and what else that they're doing that we can bring to our countries. We can bring to our region to develop so that it can benefit our societies.
But she told me it's been driven by the industry, which then helped to inform policy over time.
I think the difference is Samoa has the support of the government. And for PNG, we've done this. We've been advocating to look within, and we also need the support from our government. And we've seen that through the developments that have happened already in the ICT space. We had the Coral Sea cable landing here in PNG, which still has to be rolled out to the rest of the country in terms of reaching the last mile. We have discussions around electronic transaction, which was actually passed just recently this month, where they passed the Electronic Transaction Bill, Transaction Act Bill, which will give confidence in going into digital trade.
Priscilla Kevin there, co-founder of Infonet and PNG IT specialist, and our reporter there, Dubrovka Voladei, with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Time now for our weekly stroll through the Pacific Beat news garden, as it were, as we seek out the roses, the thorns, and some bananas too from the week gone by. Joining us this morning to share the stories that have made an impact on them are Julian Ligo, owner of the Yumi Tok Tok Street website. Julian, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning.
And also with us, Sanya Ruggiero, Communications and Advocacy Analyst with the UN Office in Suva. Sanya, welcome to the program once again.
Hi, Richard. Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, I think we should probably start with the bad news story for both of you of the week, the thorn, as we like to call it, because you've both focused on the situation in Solomon Islands and particularly in Honiara. So, Sanya, if I can put it to you first, I mean, from your view in Suva, what do you make of it all? How much of a shock has it been to you?
Yeah, Richard, it's you know, it's a huge shock for us over here. Definitely, you know, just on from the a personal side, you know, the great relationship that so many Fijians share with the Solomon Islands. And then, of course, from the UN side, I was there in Honiara in 2019. And, you know, I know this is a cliche saying, and people say this sort of thing all the time, but I really, really had, you know, such a wonderful experience with the people there. And to see just, you know, so many parts of Honiara going up in flames like this is completely heartbreaking. And it's really, you know, it's really made, I know here in Fiji, a lot of us just pause and sort of get out of our own kind of, you know, bubble and our own sort of, you know, daily, you know, we're not happy with this, we're not happy with that, and then still focused a lot on the COVID situation. It's just been a complete shock for us here.
And Julian from Vanuatu, I mean, what do you make of it all?
Well, being Melanesian, it's a bit, you know, you wonder sometimes how people can achieve what they believe or what they want as a result from all this. But, you know, it is a bit difficult to understand why you burn in loot. I mean, how is that a protest? And that's something here that a lot of people here, even me, I don't understand. I don't get. You want to remove a prime minister, and yet you do something that harms other people. So I saw this clip of a woman crying because they burnt down a bank close to their home, and it made all the families that live around the surrounding area, you know, they got scared, frightened. And I was thinking, how will you achieve what you're after by burning and looting? And then there's images of people getting selfish food and stuff. And it's a COVID-19 period in the Melanesian region. It's a bit hard to go through all this. And then this happens. You kind of feel there's a lot of sympathy for the families affected. And I'm not sure what they're going to do. I've heard the Australian army's coming in or something, but yeah, it is sad for us here just to see them, because you see images go up. It's a bit hard to comprehend them.
And Sanya, I'm just wondering whether you're able to put a sort of a UN hat on this particular topic. I mean, could you see this, if the situation gets worse? I mean, the UN may have to get involved, may it not?
Yeah, you know, there's always that element of it that at the end of the day, you know, as in the Pacific, I mean, the main mandate of the UN here has, you know, usually always been disaster preparedness. And of course, we're entering the cyclone season for so many countries as well. We've already entered. And it now with this conflict, you know, when we went in 2019, we knew that Solomon Islands was a very unusual case because it was both a pre and a post-conflict setting, something very rare, definitely in the South Pacific. And, you know, there were different calls even back then that, you know, there were, of course, some of the country, Malaita in particular, were not happy with at that point, the very recent move to form ties with China. And so, yes, it's a complete balancing act. And, you know, an interesting fact for people listening is some of you may not know that Taiwan is not formally recognized by the UN. But China is. And there's just all of these, you know, these really, really sensitive nuances to this. So, yes, you're completely right, Richard. I mean, you know, the UN tends to always wait on the periphery until requested by the government of a country for support. But it's, yeah, at the moment, it's not looking too good.
All right. Well, let's put a more positive spin on what we're talking about here in the forum. And Julian, I'll ask you for your rose story of the week, the one that's made you smile a bit. And I think this centres around Vanuatu's own branding for what they're sending into the Australian market starting in January, I believe.
Yeah, we've got a program here called the Vanuatu Export Program. It's managed by the Department of Industry. So we've come up with a brand called Toffee, and it's we're hoping that this brand will take us into the Australian markets. We've already started off with samples, frozen the fruit samples, vegetables, fruits, and now we're doing seafood this 3rd of December. But we've never done a huge breakthrough into the Australian market with the products here. So it's something new, and we're hoping, you know, we could get some reach into the Australian markets with this new brand. It's all financed and sponsored by the government as well, so we'll see how it goes.
And I suppose, bearing in mind how hard Vanuatu has been hit, like most of the rest of the Pacific Island countries, with the absence of a tourist industry during the pandemic, I mean, anything the country can do to generate extra income has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, of course. I think the exports and agriculture now has been encouraged to take the forefront in business, as tourism's practically all gone. So we're just trying to look forward to see if the food products, food and beverage, food crop exports, live cattle, and other heavy body products could, you know, bring us the revenue. But we're hoping it's a bit hard, but we'll see how it goes.
And Sanya, the story that you've picked out as your rose for this week, this is interesting in the light of the pandemic that we're still in the midst of. Of course, once upon a time, the thing that occupied the world's concerns over infection was HIV, and now we're being told a woman in Argentina has beaten the virus without drugs or treatment. And this sounds pretty amazing. What's the background here?
Yeah, absolutely right, Richard. So just as you said, and also, you know, the only other time we've heard of this is a few years ago. Now, the only other recorded case was of a man who had received, I believe, I think it was a bone marrow transplant, and had then gone on to beat HIV without any medicine. Now, a woman in Argentina has reportedly also done the same with the virus, so without drugs or treatment. And doctors believe that the patient's immune system just did it on its own, eradicated the HIV on its own. So both discoveries are significant, both the woman and the man. And if scientists, what they're saying is if they can replicate this process that their bodies went through, it could lead to a cure for HIV. And that, I thought, is just absolutely, absolutely groundbreaking.
It's interesting because I think, bearing in mind that the huge scare there was around the world for a number of years when HIV first came to light, and then essentially it's faded into the background now, but certainly in the Pacific it's still very much an issue, and getting treatment and protection is not the easiest thing to do. So if they found a cure, I mean, that really would be a remarkable step forward.
Definitely, exactly. And, you know, just in the UK, they announced also this past week that they had just approved the use of, you know, the retroviral drugs being administered through an injection rather than having to take these medication every day. And that's something that's been approved in the UK, Scotland, Ireland as well. And so I'm really hopeful for these advancements on the HIV/AIDS side.
Absolutely. Some remarkable developments potentially there. Now, let's take a look at the stories that have made both of you smile this week. First of all, Julian, we're talking about seasonal workers from Vanuatu being asked to take family planning on, basically. And these are female workers, and they're perhaps being asked one or two awkward questions by their husbands back at home, as I understand it. Is that right?
So the recruitment agencies here, I don't really know the names of which, but so a few workers turned up to register to go over to Australia for seasonal work. And one of the requirements was they need to take family planning. So they went back home to the husbands and said, oh, there's a requirement here you need to see. So they handed the document over to the husband, and the husband goes, oh, where are you guys going to go work? Are you going on the farm or are you going to go work in the boat? So it's a bit funny. The husbands keep going, are you sure you guys are not going to work on the farms? Because this doesn't look like you're going on a farm. And you know, it now becomes a topic on social media here. So everyone's making comments saying, oh, there must be another work up there besides farm work or seasonal work. They might be recruiting for something else. Go check them out. So that's the topic of this week that really got people going.
I can imagine because, I mean, apart from anything else, it doesn't exactly set the situation off on the best foot if a couple are going to be separated for some months, does it?
Yeah, they get separated for, well, there's some that go for 9 months, some that go for 3 years, and then the wife turns up to the house as soon as she registered to be recruited and goes, well, there's a requirement, I need to take family planning. And, you know, as men, we know how that feels.
Yes, that's an interesting one. I'm not surprised it stirred up a bit of discussion on social media. Now, Sanya, your story centres around the world's wealthiest dog. I mean, this is a seriously wealthy dog as well. Tell us more.
I know. Oh, my gosh. So, you know, I was shocked to open the news at some point in this past week, and I see the headline, "The World's Wealthiest Canine is Selling Miami Estate for $32 million. And of course, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me, Sanya. Probably don't open this. You know, it's probably not going to be the best article to read in the middle of a really busy day as you're struggling through a work day. But open it, I did. So the world's apparently this German shepherd named Gunther the Sixth, who's apparently worth $500 million. Now he's selling his Miami estate, and the estate once belonged to Madonna. Now the little legend behind it is that Gunther, you know, apparently he's been around for 20 years. So the story is that there was a late German countess named Carlotta who died in 1992 and had no children, but cherished her animals and left her multi-million-dollar fortune to Gunther's grandfather, Gunther the Third. And now we see here that Gunther the Sixth has inherited this trust, which has now grown to $500 million because whoever his caretakers or guardians are invested the money. So he's, you know, Gunther's doing really, really, really good, to put it very mildly.
Absolutely. Yeah, they talk about it being a dog's life worth $500 million. That's not bad, is it?
Not bad at all, I tell you. So, yeah, that just hit me really hard. And the rumor is that, you know, Gunther comes from a lineage dating back 40 years and six generations. You know, I'm not sure if I can trace my own lineage that far back, but clearly, you know, Gunther's got a lot of people.
Does someone manage that for the dog? Is there a management there?
Are you volunteering?
Yeah, I know. Julia, we could probably go apply.
All right. Well, I think we'll end on that extraordinary note about a very wealthy animal over there. It has to be in the United States, doesn't it? Sanya, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Julian, thank you too for joining us on our Friday forum. Sanya Ruggiero, Communications and Advocacy Analyst with the UN Office in Suva. Julian Ligo, owner of the yummy.straight website, and of course, posts galore on social media if you want to follow them. And just returning to our top story this morning, the situation in Solomon Islands, where Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare is blaming foreign powers for encouraging civil unrest in his nation. Although he's not naming names, but he has told the ABC he believes his government's decision to switch its diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China 2 years ago is the main issue behind the protests. However, a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Affairs Department says that the countries have enjoyed, quote, sound development with fruitful outcomes in the past 2 years. The spokesman goes on to say that all attempts to disrupt the normal development of relations between China and Solomon Islands are just futile. That's the view from Beijing, but closer to home in Solomon Islands, still high tension. And we will continue to keep you posted with developments here on Pacific Beat. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks very much indeed for your company. Enjoy a very peaceful, we hope, weekend.